Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are. We have listeners now in Europe, so I suppose it's good evening to you. This is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and I just noticed a new Newsweek poll which has the number of Americans believing that Saddam was behind 9/11 rising, that's rising, to 41%. Well, that's almost half the Americans, ladies and gentlemen, who believe that Saddam was responsible despite absolutely no evidence, not one shred of evidence. In fact, there is an abundance of evidence to the contrary, not least of which had Saddam actually hating Osama bin Laden. Why do I mention this? Well, these are the people who will be responsible in large measure for choosing your next president. Many of these people, I would suggest, an inordinately large percentage of these people, were people who took subprime loans with no idea of what they were getting themselves into. Yes, they were lied to, of course, no question about that. But they nevertheless took responsibility for a transaction that was manifestly not in their best interest. And probably worst of all, that these are the people who are going to have to make rational decisions about the economic and other aspects of their lives as we descend into the next Great Depression. So one really has to wonder, you know, what hope there is. George Bush was publicly talking about the economy today, saying that indeed things are not looking good, and implying that there would be some tax rebates for everyone. It's generally considered that we're looking at about $800 per person. The government, as you know, is broke. Now we have the specter of them giving back money that they don't have, with, of course, no concomitant spending reductions. A very, very grim picture, I would say. Guess who made this comment in Congress a few weeks ago? The typical American is not experiencing negative effects of the declining dollar. Well, no prizes for guessing that it was indeed Ben Bernanke, the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman. This poor man is truly the proverbial deer caught in the headlights at this point. He really doesn't have a clue what to do. I'm not sure that I blame him. He is, after all, taking a fall for the execrable Greenspan. I don't know what I would do in his position, quite frankly. I know that there is nothing, in effect, that the government or anyone else can do about the situation which is about to befall the world, not just the United States. The rot is too far gone. The perpetrator of the nonsense, of course, is now out of a job, or rather into a new job with a hedge fund company, the very people that benefited from his injudicious policies. I came across an article the other day, actually, which I thought was interesting, and it talked about Anna Schwartz, who was known as the high priestess of the U.S. Monetarism, a revered figure at the Fed. She's 92 years old and, as they say, defiantly lucid. She still works every day at the National Bureau of Economic Research in New York, where she has worked since 1941. So she is pretty well known and very much taken seriously. She now says that the central bank is itself the chief cause of the credit bubble, and now seems stunned as the consequences of its own actions engulf the financial system. And I quote, "The new group at the Fed is not equal to the problem that faces it." And that's daring to utter a thought that fellow critics mostly keep to themselves. And I continue to quote, "They need to speak frankly to the market and acknowledge how bad the problems are, and acknowledge their own failures in letting this happen. This is what is needed to restore confidence. There never would have been a subprime mortgage crisis if the Fed had been alert. This is something Alan Greenspan must answer for." Well, end of quote. The tale of the early 30s is actually intricate but worth visiting in the climate of today's credit crunch. The October 1929 crash did not cause the slump, but it was merely a vivid detail. The U.S. economy muddled through for another year, seemingly sound, and only then buckled as rising defaults in the farm belt set off a run on local banks. Well, during that time, the Chicago Fed insisted into the depths of the deflation that inflation still lurked, that there was an abundance of funds, that speculators had to be punished, and that bad banks should fail. The staggering blindness of the Fed backwoodsman from 1930 to 1933 is hard to exaggerate. You know, in hindsight, it seems astonishing that the Fed raised the discount rate twice in late 1931 to 3.5%, even as global finance was disintegrating. Well, according to Schwartz, she says, she is scornful of Greenspan's campaign to clear his name by blaming the bubble on Asian savings glut, which purportedly created stimulus beyond the control of the Fed by driving down global bond rates. And I quote, "This attempt to exculpate himself is not convincing. The Fed failed to confront something that was evident. It can't be blamed on global events." Okay, this is Richard Martin, and you are listening to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you from Miami, Florida, through PRN in New York City. My direct phone line, if, in case you'd like to call me in private, is 305-357-5575. Let me repeat that. 305-357-5575. My email address is rmartin@gscorporation.com. I will repeat that. Please write out the word corporation in full. The address should be written in lower case. And again, here it is, rmartin@gscorporation.com. G for global, S for strategic, where I work, Global Strategic Investments. Right. Now, if you would like to call in with a question, please feel free to do so. And the number to call is a toll-free number to the studios of the Progressive Radio Network in New York, and it is 888-873-4643. I will repeat that. 888-873-4643. And you will be put on hold just until I have an appropriate moment to introduce you and your call. So please be patient. and we'll get to you as soon as possible. Okay. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about ways in which you can control your life, in particular, obviously, your finances. You have seen that the markets have fallen quite substantially and continue to fall as we speak over the last few days and weeks, which is what, of course, we've all been waiting for. So this is not bad news for those people who took steps in time. But I wanted to discuss a little bit about how it works in terms of the ways in which you can control your destiny and the ways in which you can't, what you can do and what you really can't, practically speaking, be responsible for. And in that respect, I'm going to recommend a book which I think I may have mentioned before, but it's a very prescient book for those people who are trying to discover in their lives what elements they have control over and really where they have no control and how to understand that. The book is by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, that's T-A-L-E-B, who is a former trader on Wall Street, and his book is called The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. Okay, The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, from Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Okay, he says that, you know, we spend much of our lives concerned about the future, trying to anticipate what will happen next in order to protect our families and maximize our opportunities. Experts on TV analyze news events and offer predictions. Government and industry computers crunch mountains of data to measure the risks we face. So how come we keep getting surprised by momentous events such as the stock market plunge in 1987 and the tragic terrorist attacks on September the 11th, 2001? He points out that black swans don't have to be negative. Some black swans have changed society in profoundly positive ways, such as the discovery of cholesterol-lowering drugs and the meteoric rise of Google. Here, in the book, he explains how black swans will play a larger role in the world and what we can do to deal with them. So the question is, aren't we pretty good at forecasting? After all, we make lots of accurate predictions about life every day. And he says, we are very successful at predicting short-term, somewhat inconsequential events, such as the best time to leave for work to beat the traffic and how much groceries we need for the coming week. This ability has been developed by mankind through centuries of hunter-gathering. It is the major events that we fail to predict. So the question is, why do we have such trouble predicting more important stuff? And he says, because our internal mechanism for estimating the potential role of chance events is too antiquated for the complexity of the modern world. Historically, we have had to deal with far fewer variables, less information, and a smaller number of theories to explain it all. Our ancestors lived in a highly predictable habitat. There were many small surprises, but few large ones. Nowadays, communication is so effortless, society so intermingled, that almost no one's future works out as planned. What matters most to us today isn't the chance of rain or whether you can catch something for dinner. What matters now are complex economic and socio-political events, such as the rise in oil prices and the fall of the Soviet Union. The larger problem is that we resist the notion that our existence is getting more unpredictable. It's scary to think what happens is often just a matter of luck. We would rather fool ourselves with the illusion of control. So can't we learn from our past mistakes? And he says, the way we dissect these highly complex events after they happen is the major reason we fail to forecast the future. In an effort to make sense of an event, we tend to oversimplify what we could have done differently. For example, The 9/11 Commission concluded that the tragedy might have been averted if only we had had a more vigilant airport security system. But reality is not so cut and dried. Say that 1 year before the attacks, an astute member of Congress had predicted an attack and recommended the Commission's changes. He wouldn't have been greeted as a visionary. The airline industry would have attacked him for instituting costly regulations, and passengers would have vilified him for creating unbearable delays. So the question is, well, still, there have been no terrorist attacks in the U.S. since 2001. Haven't our efforts made us more secure? And Nassim replies, I think it's a false sense of security. The lessons we drew from 9/11 may reduce the chances of a similar type of attack, but it won't help us predict the next one any more than the lessons of Vietnam prevented us from getting bogged down in Iraq. So should we stop trying to predict the future? We should focus on adjusting to the existence of black swans rather than trying to predict them. Let me give you an example. Seung Hui Cho, the troubled young man who killed 32 students at Virginia Tech University. In hindsight, it was clear that Cho should have been hospitalized. Instead, he was released. The mental health system failed. What is the appropriate response? Spend enormous resources to improve the system, right? But statistically, there have been hundreds of thousands of troubled students who never became mass murderers. Can we really know the next time someone is about to cross the line? A smarter response to black swans is not to try to anticipate when they'll occur, but rather to establish more forward-thinking platforms of prevention. For instance, we should enhance security on campuses. It's not unimaginable that would-be terrorists have taken note of the relative ease and dramatic national impact of a massacre on a campus. So the question is, what can we do personally about black swans? And he says, you can empower yourself. First, stop making silly mistakes due to overconfidence. We are so anxious to feel secure and maximize our opportunities that we would rather accept the predictions of experts and pay them handsomely, even if we know they are wrong. I'm amazed that investors hand over so much of their money to money managers who say they can beat the market but often can't. Second, worry more about the rare catastrophe that has the potential to ruin you rather than the high probability events that just inconvenience you. For example, most people keep a low deductible on their car insurance because they don't want to shell out money for the inevitable fender bender. But when it comes to injury liability in the event they hurt someone in an auto accident, they insure for only the state-required minimum. The black swan in this case isn't the fender bender. It's injuring someone else. You don't expect it will ever happen, but it can bankrupt you if it does. The solution is obvious. Raise your deductible and use the money you save in premiums to pump up your injury liability coverage. Third, focus on black swans you can control. There's not a lot you can do to prevent a plane from crashing. On the other hand, there is a lot you can do to minimize your risk of diabetes. You can lose weight, eat right, etc. Well, there's a taste of the book, ladies and gentlemen. The author is Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and the book is called The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. And I'm sure you can see how this can be applied to organizing your financial circumstances to accept what is obviously some form of black swan which is sailing towards us, but we're not quite sure what it is, but we do know that it's going to be very, very severe. I have warned you about this, cheating perhaps a little bit, because if there is a black swan, I've kind of announced its presence prematurely, but nevertheless, I have given you and hope to continue to give you lots of useful and creative ways in which you can protect yourselves against the tsunami of financial events, which I believe is about to hit. All right. Again, let me give you my studio's toll-free number for you to call in with any questions you may have. It is 888-873-4640. 8-7-3-4-3. Once more, 888-873-4643. All right, now I'm going to talk to you right now about a very, very serious problem that many of you may not have heard about. I have briefly touched on it before, but I think it needs more attention here. It is the bond market insurance companies, which are seeing very great crises now in their activities, the two major ones being MBIA and Ambac Financial. And let me explain what the real problem is. First of all, a simple problem is that the share price has collapsed in both cases. In mid-November, MBI was quoted at 70. It's now down to 9 and change. Ambac, which was at 95 in mid-November, is now down to 5. And you'd say that's bad enough. But here's the real bombshell here, ladies and gentlemen. Both these companies are AAA rated by the ratings companies. Now, this, of course, is a scandal which should shock you all, because when you realize that these companies are teetering on the verge of bankruptcy, you have to ask yourself, why are these companies still maintaining their AAA ratings by such agencies as Standard & Poor's and Moody's? Well, the answer is very simple. It has nothing to do with their value. Again, you're being lied to by the people who should know better. The loss of a AAA credit rating for either of these two companies or any other of the insurers could negatively affect the ratings of $2.4 trillion worth of municipal bonds and structured finance debt that these companies guarantee. Now, I did mention this the other day, that the amount of money that either of these companies have on hand to cover any kind of shortfall that is as a result of their guaranteed bonds in the municipal bond arena is a pittance. It's a tiny fraction of what they would need should a significant number of these bonds default. Well, now, if these companies were to have their credit rating downgraded, it would cripple the ability of these companies to continue underwriting new bonds for these municipalities, which will put them in severe trouble, because obviously if they can't underwrite the bonds, then the people don't get the services they need, which are provided by the state. I mean, it's a huge crisis of both political and social consequences. Again, we're talking about $2.4 trillion of municipal bonds. You know, this problem in turn would create a ripple effect by crimping the ability of states and local governments to borrow money by raising their costs at precisely the worst time. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, when I've been telling you stay away from municipal bonds, perhaps you're beginning to understand why they are such a great and grave risk to anyone's portfolio today, and why you should stick to federal government bonds for the duration. You know, many of the short-term bonds of MBIA have tumbled as much as 12% since they were sold last week on concern that the world's largest bond insurer may need to tap investors for more money. In other words, raise their capitalization. The double A debt fell as low as 88.5 cents on the dollar, which is an equivalent yield of 18%. Now, Ambac lost more than a third of its market value on Wednesday after it slashed its dividend by two-thirds. It replaced its chief executive and said it would write down $5.4 billion from its portfolio. Ambac also said it plans to raise $1 billion with new stock and other instruments, which is part of a critical effort to maintain its AAA financial strength rating. Well, Moody's announcement came after Ambac, hard hit by the turmoil in credit markets, said it was recording a $3.5 billion write-down, which is equivalent to nearly two-thirds of its net worth, and it plans to raise the $1 billion in new capital to maintain its credit ratings. You know, someone called Dilip Shahani, who's a credit analyst with HSBC in Hong Kong, he said, and I quote, "A AAA-rated company getting money at 14% is ludicrous, in my opinion. The market is not happy with that." Well, yes, Mr. Shahani, it is ludicrous. It just goes to show everyone how bad the rating agencies are when there is this discrepancy between what the market is saying and what the rating agencies are saying. We saw exactly the same thing with Enron, and we're seeing it again now. So what can AmBac do? Raise money at 17% or 25%? Eliminate the rest of its dividend? Announce bankruptcy? Well, it seems to me that bankruptcy is probably the alternative which makes the most sense. Not only is AmBac's credibility severely tarnished and its AAA rating in severe doubt, it now has to compete against Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett. The message from the market today is that the survival of AmBac and MBIA is in severe doubt. Losing the AAA rating may be the final death blow for these companies. Well, it's difficult to know what could be more severe and what could be more serious in the bond market than having, you know, their very own insurers going under. I shudder to think. I mean, it's not something that I had mentioned. It's something that came up quite out of the blue, and of course it has to do with the derivative situation that I've discussed in so much detail. You know, in a general context, the recent concern about higher loan losses is really no surprise, and this is likely to continue. You know, it's not simply a problem that will go away if various financial companies sort of come clean with what their CDOs and so forth are worth. The real problem is that companies don't know what they're worth because the foreclosures that will determine their value haven't happened yet. The defaults are just starting. The heaviest round of mortgage resets only started in October. So it'll probably be months before we observe mass delinquencies and several more months until we observe significant foreclosures, loan losses, and write-offs. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a multi-year problem, not a multi-week problem that can be resolved by just coming clean with what's on the balance sheet. You know, according to the latest FDIC banking profile, FDIC-insured institutions currently hold a notional value of $153.8 trillion in credit derivatives. Yes, that is trillion with a T. Although GDP itself is only about 13 trillion, the high notional value emerges because for each derivative that connects two true so-called end users, one long, one short, there is a whole chain of intermediaries who are long with one intermediary and short with another, hoping to earn a tiny profit on the spread. For example, I buy a derivative from Andy, who goes short to me, so he buys one from Barry, who is short to Andy, hopefully for a tiny spread, and covers the risk by buying a derivative from Charlene and so on until someone finds a true end user who actually wants to carry a pure short position in that derivative. Unfortunately, this also exposes banks to as yet unknown counterparty risk. If one link in the chain snaps, the links surrounding that chain have to bridge the gap. This is not a material risk in exchange-traded derivatives, but can be a problem in over-the-counter derivatives traded simply between banks where know thy counterparty currently ought to be chiseled into every marble surface. So again, you have a situation where no regulation leads to, you know, the law of the jungle. You know, major global financial institutions have racked up losses to date of over $100 billion, and I don't think we've even seen all the losses emerge. There are more losses to come in prime mortgages, credit cards, commercial real estate, private equity loans, and junk bonds. Similar problems are emerging in England, in Ireland, and in Spain. To put the number into perspective, the U.S. savings and loan losses in the 1980s totaled around $240 billion. That's in 2007 dollars. As they say, a billion here and a billion there, and soon you're talking real money. Now, the $1 to $2 trillion of assets that banks have parked off balance sheet in special purpose structures are coming back onto their balance sheets. Banks must find the money for this. They also need capital to cover the losses and the assets coming back. You know, all this is going to choke off credit creation and bring on a sharp contraction in the availability of credit. This will reduce economic growth and asset prices around the world. It is certainly the most serious crisis that this country has ever experienced in its 200 to 300 year history. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I do my best. I really try to bring this information to you. Some of it may be a little esoteric, a little bit above what the average person can really digest, but I see no other way to bring this to you. You need to know. You need to know what's happening, and it's not pretty. Right, we have in New York a caller named Tom. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Richard.
I had
two quick questions. One, Treasury money markets in a lot of the large broker firms like Fidelity, is that safe?
Yes.
That is, okay.
Yeah, it's safe because basically all of the money in any brokerage house that belongs to you is segregated. So in other words, it's never going to be commingled with the funds of the company, so that even if anything goes wrong with the company, your funds will be safely set aside in accounts which are yours and yours alone. It's not like a bank, Tom. In a bank, in the situation of a bank, your money is lent to the bank, and the bank can then lend it out, so there is a risk. When you own treasury paper, your money has not been lent to anybody. It is your paper, and it must be segregated by law in separate accounts. Okay?
And the second part is, when you mention MBIA and Warren Buffett, people are saying Warren Buffett is going to make a fortune by competing with MBIA now. I'm assuming, though, you still would not buy his stock. Is that correct?
No, I did. We talked about Warren Buffett in one of my previous shows. I think Mr. Buffett may have come to the end of his line. He's been an extremely lucky man. He has lived most of his professional life in an ongoing bull market, in what we call a super bull market, a super cycle bull market, with little dips here and there, but basically never having to suffer a severe downturn. He got into the market in 1975, right at the bottom, and he just closed his eyes and rode it up the whole way. My feeling is that it is his turn to see the kind of devastating effects that have hit other people in less fortunate circumstances. And I don't think he's going to make the right decision if he gets involved with this kind of activity now, Tom. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
George in Long Island, you are on the line. Go ahead, please.
Good evening, Mr. Martin. A pleasure to speak with you again. First question, would it be better off to go into euros? Gary Noel had a man on last week, I believe, who said that our currency should go down to about 10 cents on the dollar. So if we went to euros, with the exchange rate, would we get back the same percentage in profit?
When you're talking about 10 cents on the dollar, that refers to what, George?
The dollar shrinking in value. It'd be worth 10 cents of a $19, $13.
Oh, you're confusing two things, George. You're confusing exchange rates and the purchasing power of the dollar. The purchasing power of the dollar since 1913 is already down to about 3 cents of value. From the dollar as it was in 1913 before the Federal Reserve came in and messed things up. As far as exchange rates are concerned, most other fiat currencies have lost gigantic amounts in their own right without any reference to the dollar or any other currency. The purchasing power has just been eroded over time by inflation. So there are two separate decisions to take. In other words, whether to hedge against the declining purchasing power of the dollar or whether to go into another currency. Those are two separate decisions. And so do be aware that you're not dependent on the decision of one to make a decision about the other. So is that clear, George?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have one emailed question that I would like to share with you. It is from Vince Padula. Vince, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right. You've called in or you've emailed me several times, and I always have a feeling that I'm not quite sure that I've got your name right. But anyway, Vince says as follows in his email. Richard, last night on CNN's Larry King show, there were a number of financial experts who said that now is the time to buy stocks, mutual funds, and real estate. Might you have a slightly different point of view? No, as a matter of fact, I do not have a slightly different point of view, Vince. I have a dramatically different point of view. We have talked about this on almost every show, so I don't think this comes as a surprise to you. But there is absolutely no call whatsoever for anybody to start buying assets of any kind, whether it comes to stocks, mutual funds, real estate, gold, silver, copper, commodities, whatever it may be. This is a deflationary period about to unleash itself on the world. Cash is king, okay, and only that which remains cash or cash equivalent should be purchased over the next foreseeable future. The reason for this, I think I have expounded at great length. I will continue to do so, but I don't think it requires me to give a specific answer to your email, because I think you get the basic answer, which is encapsulated in one word, i.e. no. Everything else I say on this show, Vince, is basically designed to keep you away from these markets and to keep your network intact. So thanks for the question. I hope it answers itself as time goes by. Right. I would like now to just talk very briefly about a particular problem which is going to cause a landslide of lawsuits over the next few years, which I think will dwarf anything that the dot-com bubble spewed out in terms of disgruntled investors and operators in one sense or another over these venture capital funds and dot-com companies which went bust, namely the appraisal market in real estate. I have mentioned that appraisals were a function of basically the need for mortgage brokers to inflate the values of houses in order to be able to make bigger loans. It's a very simple concept. And it's said that appraisers help to exaggerate the U.S. mortgage values by as much as 10% in 2006, and that's according to Susan Wachter, a real estate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School in Philadelphia. Lenders and investors in mortgage-backed securities depend on independent appraisals to value their collateral. Buyers use them to make sure they aren't overpaying. Mortgage lenders who were eager to make bigger loans and win market share during the five-year housing boom relied on both higher appraisals and the proliferation of subprime and adjustable-rate mortgages, said Wachter, who has consulted for mortgage buyer Freddie Mac and General Electric's U.S. Home Loan Unit. And I quote, "There has to be an appraiser who basically blesses the loan. There are lenders who are deciding what terms to extend, and then there are appraisers indicating it is appropriate or it isn't appropriate." Well, lenders and mortgage brokers routinely were pressurized to boost values, and the system was corrupted when lenders began moving mortgage applications to third-party brokers who only got paid if a loan closed. 90% of appraisers surveyed in a study published by Richfield, Ohio-based October Research Corp, said they felt pressured to make bogus valuations. 5 years ago, that figure was 55%. Almost three-quarters of the appraisers said that mortgage brokers asked them to bend the rules. Appraisers who resist pressure to inflate values said they may be blacklisted. So So Debbie Huber, a Las Vegas home appraiser, said a third of the mortgage lenders who want to hire her are looking for a guaranteed value before she appraises the property. Quote, we get calls like that every hour of every day. And this was Huber speaking. She's the past president of the Nevada Appraisal Commission, the state agency that oversees appraisers. The problem became so severe in Florida that appraiser Pamela Crowley said she started an email distribution list in 2003 for real estate appraisers to report suspicious sales and refinancing deals. Crowley said she was forced out of the appraisal business because she refused to report property values that were higher than the actual worth. She has turned the email list into a website and says she now works with a snub-nosed 38 caliber pistol at hand because she's afraid of retribution. Well, appraisal practices are drawing the study of prosecutors, finally. In New York, Attorney General Andrew Cuomo subpoenaed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two biggest buyers of U.S. mortgages. He also sued First American Corp's E-Appraisal IT LLC for allegedly caving to pressure from Washington Mutual, its biggest customer and the largest U.S. thrift, to inflate value. Cuomo said in November he uncovered, quote, a pattern of collusion between lenders and appraisers to bolster home values. The investigations call into question $4.7 trillion worth of mortgage securities guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and may limit the availability of home loans to borrowers with good credit. And that was from Frank Lee, Credit Sites, Inc. analyst, and also Sarah Rowan, who said in the November 8th report, quote, if there is a disruption in Fannie and Freddie trying to buy conventional loans, that would be very, very bad right now. End of quote. So the valuation crisis in credit markets may cost banks and investors $400 billion, according to November estimates by Deutsche Bank AG analysts. Now that's something to look forward to. At least you'll know what is going on when you are regaled with grim stories of appraisal fraud. Daryl from the Bronx. Hi, how are you?
Richard, how are you? Daryl, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. I want to thank Gary for the two websites that he gave last week as I was sounding off. Right now, I was watching a rebroadcast of Charlie Rose. You might want to take a look at it. Landon Thomas of the New York Times and somebody from the Wall Street Journal is talking about sovereign funds. And they're talking basically about the buyout of the major stockbroking companies by people who have money in other countries. And the last point that they made that before I went to speak to you was that how complicit the Congress is. I don't know if you remember the Abu Dhabi port flap over the Emirates taking over control, wanting to take over control of a company that operated out of Port Newark, I believe it is, or the ports on the East Coast. And here, billions of dollars of quote-unquote passive foreign investment is going in to control these companies like Merrill Lynch and Goldman and other companies and Citigroup that control this economy. Is there anybody talking on the street about, can we get into the sovereign funds and make some money that way? But if not, I mean, it's this, I have a disconnect in hearing that particular position.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I repeat again, especially those who don't know, who haven't listened to me before, but I don't get into politics. It's not what I'm here to do. But I remain absolutely stunned when I listen to these presidential debates by the fact that whenever they start to talk about the economy, which is, you know, precious little of the time, They're more engaged in, you know, these questions of immigration or gay rights or, you know, the role of religion in politics or whatever it is. But when you do talk about economics, my jaw just falls open when I realize how little these people understand. And the other day, just to give you an example, there was Hillary Clinton online, and they were talking about sovereign funds and the problems of the economy. And all she could find to say was that she was, and she tried to make this big deal out of the fact that she was absolutely, you know, horrified by having these sovereign funds buying up American assets and nobody really knowing who was behind them and what they might be trying to do and control. Absolutely irrelevant to the problem of the economy. Absolutely, and she has no idea how serious this is. She hasn't got a clue. She, at least if she has, she's keeping it a very good secret. And the same applies to everybody else. The problem isn't who owns the sovereign funds. The problem is whether these sovereign funds can actually do anything to alleviate the problem, as in the $7.9 billion deal from Abu Dhabi for given to Citicorp. I mean, that's a fraction of what they would need in order to bail themselves out of their problem. They're still probably technically bankrupt. And so, you know, the idea that these sovereign funds are going to sort of bail out America from its self-imposed problems is frankly ludicrous. And I'm glad you brought that up, Daryl, because it really gives me an opportunity to, again, you know, push forward the case of Ron Paul, who is, quite frankly, the only person who has a clue, and he has a lot more than a clue. He's actually studied this situation in great detail, and he knows a very great deal about it. The problem, of course, is that his solutions are so above the heads of the average American that the same guy who still thinks that Iraq is responsible for 9/11, you know, that it becomes a sad but kind of meaningless event, although obviously one should hope to support him as much as possible, and I'm hearing that there may be some kind of billionaire waiting in the wings to push his career into the kind of his candidacy into the mainstream, but that's another matter.
Can I ask you to emphasize more about the disconnect in the chain with regard to investment? I don't think people fully understand. I heard someone explaining what was the straw that broke the camel's back with regard to the prime lending scheme. And I don't think people understand that everything goes along as long as everybody in the game wants to play. When someone gets nervous about their money, and they decide, especially if they're higher up on the chain, they decide, no, I'm finished, I'm out, then that's when the thing collapses. And could you speak more about that particular position? And I'll hang up. And one more thing. Sometime we need to have a discussion about Ron Paul, because he may be very good on economics. However, being a person of color, being 58 years old, you do away with the federal government, and I have no rights in this country at all. And even though this government is totally dysfunctional straight across the board, I remember that I couldn't drink at fountains and I couldn't travel in this country without severe... Well, I can see it going back to that very easily. So we need to talk about that sometime.
Okay, Daryl.
Yes.
He's not suggesting doing away with the federal government. Not at all. He's suggesting doing away with the Federal Reserve.
Oh, that's fine, and the IRS. I agree with him in all of that. Oh, I definitely...
Your points are not relevant, as far as I understand, to him as a president in terms of your rights. I don't think that's the issue there. I think the issue is that he wants to renegotiate various elements of the society which have nothing really to do with rights. They're much more to do with the economic fundamentals by which we live here, which are probably very much in disrepute now. I think that's slightly different. Daryl, the other point that you made about why people call it, you know, who calls the tune and why they decide to stop calling the tune, there's a very simple answer to that, and I'd like to just make this point quickly before we go, because I don't think we've got too much longer here together. The reason why these subprime loans have collapsed and the reason why there is now a black hole underneath the economy is not because people just decided to pack it in and go home. It is because, and this takes us back to what the crime of Greenspan, was that when he perceived that the dot-com bubble had burst, and that therefore we were, in effect, in the same position that we find ourselves in today, Greenspan discovered that there was one other major area of assets that he could call upon to offer loans against, which would then bring more so-called economic activity into the system and basically keep the ball rolling for another period of time, however long that might be. Now, remember that we're talking a Ponzi scheme here. That's to see that in the way that you want to keep the system going, you must be able to bring in more money. Now, if there are no assets, then a capitalist system such as the United States cannot practically pledge anything against the issuance of more money or more credit. And what happened was, at the end of the dot-com bubble, yes, there was still another major item that could be pledged, namely people's houses. And that is why he allowed this housing mania to take place. He did it more for personal reasons than anything else, to make himself look good. That here was this wonderful, generous man who was offering all this money for people to go out and buy their own houses, fully knowledgeable of the fact that one day they would all collapse, because there was no way that you could allow people who could hardly afford a loan at all to take what they called a subprime loan at a teaser rate, which would then ramp up to a market rate in 2 years' time, which they would then have to live with for the next 28 years. This was all but fraud, Darryl, and that's what caused it to happen. And now that the people can't pay their loans, now that they're defaulting, now that there are foreclosures right, left, and center, the world is desperately looking around for some other kind of asset to pledge against an increased ability to loan out money and to create credit, and there isn't one. There is just nothing left, and that's the serious part about this. And that's why we know that the system now will collapse unabated, because there isn't anything left. You know, the well has run dry. And people don't get that. That's really why it's very hard for people when they hear people like Bush coming in and talking about offering everybody $800 tax rebate or something, like, which is, again, completely irrelevant to the issue. The issue is that the rot in the system was allowed to continue, courtesy of Alan Greenspan, far too long, and now the piper must be paid. The consequences become due. And that's what's going to hurt over the next few years, the sorting out of this mess and the tremendous social and economic upheaval that this will entail. And in the end, what will happen, of course, is that when the maximum number of people have lost their homes, and by the way, I'm not just referring to subprime. We're talking about prime property. We're even talking about rich people now. There was an article, I think, in the New York Times this week mentioning that rich people are now beginning to get hurt, seriously hurt themselves, because after all, rich people did the same thing as poor people, just on a much grander scale. And now that they find themselves unable to repay their loans, their properties are going to get foreclosed on too. And I'm not just talking about wealthy individuals. I'm talking about people who control large amounts of business, large amounts of wealth in many different areas. These people will be bankrupted in short order, and of course that will have a knock-on effect on far more people than, for example, the lowly house homeowner who took out a subprime mortgage, who probably will limit his effect to his personal family. So, you know, the effects really are industry-wide, economy-wide, And we'll talk a lot more about that in future occasions. But I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of our hour, and it remains for me, Richard Martin, to wish you a very nice weekend, and I look forward to talking to you next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Take care, and bye-bye for now.